history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories to be heard. If we just take the time to ask a few questions and listen, we'll be amazed by what our veterans have been through. And we want them to know, we want our veterans to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we hear these stories, we are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. And the gentleman we're going to meet today, what a life story. I mean, you could make a movie out of this. Mike DeCesar, 88 years old, lives near Madera, California. I think I saw an alpaca on the way in here, Mike, and I don't know if we're going to get into that, but your life story, I'm just amazed here. You lost your mother. You never knew your mother, right?
No, she passed away a day after I was born.
But you're one of eight children.
Eight children.
And all five of you boys were in uniform in World War II. You were way before you were even old enough to, and we're going to find out about that. But I want to hear about your childhood. What was it like growing up without a mom, and what happened to all the different kids, and how many different directions did you guys go in?
Well, actually, when my mother passed away the day after I was born, she was still young. She was only 25 years old. My brothers went into Catholic homes in New Jersey. One of them was in St. Michael's, I think, which is the hometown where Lindbergh resided. My sisters went into Catholic convents. My grandparents, which was my mother's parents, since I was only a couple of days old, they didn't want to release me, even though they had six kids of their own. And they kept me and raised me, and they had relatives that lived in Fresno. They were farmers. They had 144 acres. They had no children. And when they came back east to visit their parents, who lived down the street from my grandparents, they happened to see me. As a matter of fact, even at that age, I was getting out of school at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was working in a blacksmith shop. Mm-hmm. It's called Joe Carolina. And my job was to rake up all the slag in the dirt floor and clean all the tools and put them away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd work every day, like maybe 3 hours and half a day on Saturday.
That's at 9 years old.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And back then, well, I was 9 years old, but I was like 30 years old streets. But back then, he would give me $1 a week, which was quite a bit of money. So when these folks came out here and they saw me and they convinced my grandparents to let me move to Fresno, they said, you know, we have no children and he can work on the farm, he can make money and help you out. So that's how I ended up in Fresno.
How did you feel about that?
Well, quite frankly, I felt good about it because I didn't want to end my life working in a factory back in New Jersey. And most of the fellas that were my childhood buddies, that's what they ended up doing, working in factories or doing other things. Some of them ended up in, we call it the college, which is the state prison. So when I heard about California, of course, you know, we would see a vehicle in town with California tags and you'd go berserk. So I was all for it. 9 years old, I had a tag on me. My grandparents had a big bag. We had sandwiches in the bag and had the name and address of the folks out here and phone number. And from the Philadelphia Railroad Station, changed trains in Chicago. And I got at the Santa Fe train station in Fresno, like I think it was something a little after 8 at night on August 15th. That was it.
So all by yourself, you took that train across the country?
All by myself,
yeah,
yep.
At 9 years old?
Yep. People were good on the train. I mean, mm-hmm. You know. And, but like I say, I was 9 years old, but I was raised in a pretty rough neighborhood. I mean, they were tenement row houses. Usually you'd get in a fight every day you go to school. So anyhow, I did work when I came out here. At the time, I think I was getting like 40 cents an hour. I mean, my God, my grandfather was working in a foundry, and I think he was making like $4 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And here I'm out here making 40 cents an hour. And the folks that raised me out here, they raised plums, and they raised apricots that we used to cut and put them on trays. And we had 10 acres of truck farming. And when we were done with that, then we would go and do everything from pick olives to shaking them when they're black or picking them by hand when they're green, cutting oranges, cutting lemons. You don't plug them. You got to mm-hmm. cut them. I was making a lot of money. But, of course, in the meantime, the war comes along, and I get news that my twin brothers, the oldest brothers, whom I never knew, lost their life. They were in the Army Air Corps in Hawaii on December 7th. And then my next brother, he ends up joining the Navy. And the brother before me, he ends up joining the Navy Air Force or the Air Corps. And I just wanted to get off the farm. It was a combination of things. I was angry at the time, losing my brothers. I wasn't quite 16 years old, but I kind of jimmied my baptismal certificate. In those days, they took anything. You can go in with a parking ticket. So anyhow, I got in, and I actually ran away. And the post office, which is on Tulare Street, the old post office behind the courthouse is where we signed up. And I went through boot camp, and I was waiting to be transferred when I got notified that I had to report to division headquarters, and I didn't know what this was all about. Well, they found out I was underage, so they told me I'd have to leave the service. I was just scan under 16. So they gave me a train ticket. They said, you can come back and re-enlist. I believe at the time it was 90 days before your 17th birthday, but you had to have parental approval.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't have any parents, and these folks didn't adopt me. But what they did through Fresno Superior Court, I appointed them as my guardians. So just about 3 months before my 17th birthday, which was in the mid-1944, I went down, had the court document with a seal on it. They made me sign up, and they said, well, the day you're 17, you report here, and you'll be on the train. Of course, I had to go back to boot camp, but by then I was like an old salt, you know. I'd just walk around with a cup of coffee because I'd already been through boot camp. Then from there, you know, I got assigned to sea duty. And
I want to hear about all that, and I'm imagining folks listening. I know a little bit about your story, but people are listening, and they're hearing this for the first time. They're saying, holy cow. His mom died right after he was born, didn't know his siblings at all, goes cross-country on the train at 9. Then, oh, by the way, when America gets this word of World War II, the December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, everybody has a memory about how they found out and, you know, what that news meant to them. But for you, it's, hey, two brothers that I never got a chance to know are dead. Do you remember that day, how you found out, and then at what point you learned, you know what, my brothers were part of that?
Yeah, I remember that day very clear because the farm that the folks that raised me on was actually owned by Japanese. It was the Yoshida family.
Mm-hmm.
Very well known. In fact, some of the fellas served in the 442. And the one brother, I think, was quite an athlete at Fresno State. But because they moved him out, Frank who and Mary, the folks that raised me, they worked on that farm. But they took care of that farm while these folks were gone. The money for the crops and all, they put that away for them. And, of course, they would not come back to Fresno after the war was over because they were interned. Frank ended up buying the farm. So I distinctly remember the day that that happened. In fact, we were out in the packing shed, and he had a radio out there, an old Philco radio. We were hearing about the Japanese are bombing Pearl Harbor. Of course, I didn't realize my brothers were in Hawaii.
Right.
I didn't know that until couple of months later, and then I heard about it, and their name was Victor and Vito. They were twins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really only got to know my one brother, who did 30 years as a battleship sailor, and as I mentioned to you, he was on the Texas in the Normandy invasion
mm-hmm.
and was wounded. They tell me that he was on a cover. I thought it was Life magazine, but it may have been one of the others. When they had him on a gurney, or they were taking him on a gurney or something. So the only one that I really knew, not that well, was him. And of course, then I had my oldest sister, who just passed away this past year. She was 95, almost 96, and her husband was on the battleship Wisconsin, which he helped build at the Camden Shipyard in New Jersey, and then they moved to Fresno. I was very close with her, and that's about the only family that I really knew.
Mm-hmm.
I've never sat at the same table with brothers and sisters.
In many ways, you've been on your own for a very long time.
Yeah, so like I say, I was young, but I learned how to survive.
And so when Pearl Harbor happens, you're what, 13 years old?
I think I was just a little over 13, yeah.
Does it occur to you that this is something you might get involved in at some point?
Well, of course, like I say, I didn't know my twin brothers, even though I didn't know them, but I knew I had them. I didn't even know they were in Hawaii. I didn't know they were killed during the bombing. I understand they were at Hickam Field. Many years later, I did go over to Hawaii. They have a beautiful cemetery there. It's called the Punch Bowl.
Yeah.
It's really a dead volcano, but it's gorgeous.
Beautiful.
I tried to look them up. The curator said, well, where were they? And I told him, oh, no. He says, they took these guys. He says, they took the bodies and they buried them near the National Cemetery near Arlington. But I did look up a first cousin of mine who was a Marine. He was killed during the landing of Tarawa. But that's a beautiful facility there.
It is. Beautiful views.
You know, there was a lot of hurt. There was a lot of anger. I think at that time, a lot of people were pretty mad at the Japanese. Unfortunately, they took it out on the American Japanese.
Well, and you must have had interesting perspective on that, having worked on this farm owned by Japanese Americans. You probably didn't think of them as any different from anyone else, right?
No, in fact, they were wonderful people, let me tell you. Mrs. Ishida, she was, I can only say when she died, she must have went straight to heaven nonstop. She was a wonderful person. I mean, the whole family was great. I can imagine or try to imagine that you get noticed tomorrow morning, have your bags ready, and that's it. Take you away from your home and leave everything behind. It must have been devastating to these people.
And you're a teenager watching this happen to people you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I remember Frank just told him, and he embraced him and said that I'll take care of your place for you, and I'll make sure that everything will be here when it's over. I mean, that's very vivid to me. But, you know, it was a difficult time for me at that time.
Do you remember having any aspirations at that young age, thinking, boy, someday I'm going to do this and this and this?
Well, I wanted to do it right then and there, but I knew I couldn't. I mean, you know, especially I see shortly thereafter, my other brother, he goes into the Navy. He's on a battleship. That looked very good to me.
That was part of the impetus of you lying about your age and sneaking in?
Yes, and I wasn't the only one. In fact, there were thousands of people that, men and women, as a matter of fact, I understand the youngest female was a Navy wave, and I understand she was only 13. And I understood that there was a Marine, and I understood he was only like 13 and a half, and the day he turned 17, he got the Medal of Honor. They have an organization, underage veterans, you know, but I belong to so many, I just don't have the time. I still work. I still have an active office, as you see.
Well, that did strike me as you were talking about the work you did at the age of 9. And how you'd get done at school at 1 o'clock and get to work and work on the weekends and all that. I said, well, I guess if you start working early, then you keep working a long time because here you are. Before long, you're going to be 90, and I don't think you're going to have stopped working yet.
No, I don't think so. In fact, doctors tell me at the VA, I don't have a better medicine to give you. Of course, when I came out here, I never went back to school. Once again, thanks to the military, they had a program, and I don't know whether it's still in force. We used to call it USAFI, stands for United States Armed Forces Institute. It was a correspondence course. You can take your tests. You had to do it in front of two officers, and if you passed, you got a GED certificate, which I did. And I did 2 years of junior college and came out. Under the GI Bill, I was able to attend LaSalle University. I got a law degree. I never took the bar. I went to work for insurance companies in the litigation division. I've been doing that now for going on 61 years.
And it seems like you still really enjoy it.
Oh, I do. And I like helping people, especially the way things are going. After the company I worked for a number of years, they sold out. And then I got an independent adjuster's license representing companies. And I used to represent 108 insurance companies beside American Airlines, United Airlines, TWA, and so forth. And then in 2008, I thought, well, I got to cut back a little, and I transferred my state license in California as a public adjuster, where I'm an advocate for the policyholder, but I am licensed in 22 states.
Is that all?
Yeah. and I have, for many years, a private investigator's license in quite a few states, including California. One of the other things the Navy was good to me while I was in the reserves, I attended a three-year class. My certificate's on the wall there, which was the construction of docks and piers. How I really got into, years later, as a independent adjuster representing insurance companies. A number of years ago, Lake Elsinore down south had a flash flood. And it wiped out everything. And attorneys found out that I am a Marine certified Marine surveyor and Marine construction on docks and piers. And they hired me to give an estimate to rebuild everything. The docks, I mean, the floating sheriff's office, the floating bathrooms, the fuel tanks, the fuel dock, in which I recreated everything. And I think there was something like a $50 million lawsuit on it. And I think I came up with $13 million. That's what the jury awarded. So I did a pretty good job.
I guess you did.
So thanks to the Navy and thanks to the military. And I think about the young kids today that will not have an opportunity to finish high school and will never go to college. And they should set their sights on the military. It's not all fighting on the front line. You can learn a trade, do your 20 years, good benefits, GI Bill. It was a great life. And I can honestly say that, without exaggerating, I never had a bad day in the Navy.
Well, I want to hear about some of those days, and some other people might have a different opinion. They might have felt it was a bad day, and it might just be your perspective. But so you're 16 years old. You're not quite 17 when they actually let you back in.
Yes.
Right? Official this time. You're no longer lying about your age. How did you end up in submarines? Is that something you volunteered for?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, when I went back in, I noticed on a bulletin board they had a notice up there that they were looking for volunteers for the submarine service. And of course, at that age, you know, you're curious. I thought, wow, that's really got to be something. So they did a 2-day tour. I think there was 21 or 22 of us. And they took us to New London, and we went aboard. Of course, these are the old diesel electric, the Gatto class and those classes, and went through them and seen them. And I mean, the more you seen, the more you got excited. So I decided, okay, so I got it. And they took us out on one of the older boats. They call them boats. They don't call them ships.
Right.
We were out about 100 miles offshore in the Atlantic, and all of the candidates had headsets on. These are all voice power activated, and you hear everything that's going on. They had a whole bunch of chief petty officers with charts, and they would watch each person and mark and see how they act. And all of a sudden, everything went black and everything stopped. I mean, you're under the water, they're electric motors, you hear the whirring of the motors, whirring of it, and everything stops. And then you hear the captain. He said, "We've lost all power. We're going to ease down to the bottom." You can feel hitting the bottom. You're probably down about maybe 110 feet. And then you're hearing back and forth. You know, well, we got this problem, we got that problem, and you're listening to it, all the candidates, and they're watching you. And guys that start to look like they're going to panic, they start grading them. We're down there about 4.5 hours.
With no power that whole time?
No power. The only thing we have on is battle lights, which are battery lanterns.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the captain comes on, and he says, "Chief engineer tells us we have one chance to get to the surface. If you see a blue flash go through the boat, I'll see you topside. If you don't see the blue flash, I'm going to be topside. Some of you guys may be down below," meaning heaven or hell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, the blue flash happened. We get up to the top. Then we find out it was a training process. Well, out of 22, there was only, I think, 4 of us that passed. They flunked the rest of them out.
Were you on the verge of panic, or were you
no.
calm, cool, and collected the whole
no,
time?
No, I figured, hey, you know, I can't get out, so I'm
Where am I going to go?
Where am I going to go? I mean, you know, I'm sure the captain and everybody else wants to go home, so I'll just stick with it. What's going to happen is going to happen.
And you're probably the youngest kid in there.
I was, as a matter of fact, yeah. That's what they used to call me, Mikey the Kid.
Uh-huh.
That was my title.
What do you mean used to?
No, they just call me Mike.
And I think we can call him full of surprises. Time for a break, but when we come back, we'll hear about his experiences on submarines in the Pacific during World War II, as well as his work right after the war as a salvage diver with primitive equipment like you saw Cuba Gooding Jr. use in the film Men of Honor. Check out Mike's photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right, consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 88-year-old Mike DeCesar of Madera, California. We've heard a lot already that tugs at the heartstrings, but we haven't heard about the war patrols he participated in as a 17-year-old aboard the World War II submarine USS Sennett.
I finished sub-school, and then by NATS, Naval Air Transport Service, they flew us out here to California. From California, flew us to Hawaii. Then I was assigned to the Sennett, which is a 408 boat. We are actually operated in the Pacific. A lot of people would say, were you dip charged? Were you this? Were you that? You know, how many torpedoes did you fire? Well, I never fired any. I was electrician's mate, you know. But there was some action. Sennett had a good battle record. Our skipper's name was Porter. I think he was from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Good guy, lieutenant commander.
What was the biggest challenge to life on a World War II era diesel sub?
Well, number one, you had to share your bunk with somebody else. You don't do that on a nuclear sub today. In fact, my oldest son that I mentioned to you, he was on the Andrew Jackson, which is a nuclear ballistic submarine out of Charleston. He would always rib me. He says, you know, you guys, what, 72 hours you had to come up? We could stay under 6 months. I said, but you weren't on a submarine. You were on a Hilton hotel. You had air conditioning, humidity control. You had your own bunk. No, I like I said, I never had a bad day. You keep busy. You're really busy. I mean, you have an assignment to do, and you got to do that assignment. You don't worry about these other things, you know. What's going to happen is going to happen. You accept that fact. It's just like if you're a paratrooper. You know, you jump. Is the thing going to open or is it not?
Right.
You do it.
And we've heard a lot of veterans say that, hey, I just had to do what I was told, what my assignments were. So what were your duties aboard that submarine?
Well, of course, the submarines, you know, the old diesel electric and the control panels and everything. Once you submerge, you're on batteries. Mm-hmm. So you're operating electric. When you surface, you're on diesel engines.
Right.
And if I may, at this time, one thing I will say about the Nazi U-boats, they were able to be partially submerged and operate off of their diesel engines.
Right.
And the reason they did that is there was some engineer, as I understood the story, was watching his daughter playing with a string that had a tennis ball on it. You flip it in the air and you try and catch it in a cup. And he got the idea, if I can design two pipes to go up in the bridge near the periscopes, one to suck in air and one to let the exhaust out, we can run our diesels. And they called that a snorkel. U-boats had it. We did not.
Right. But typically, especially where you were in the Pacific, you're not dealing with U-boats, but you are dealing with enemy aircraft, enemy ships. You're trying to sink enemy ships. And it's kind of an all-or-nothing proposition, isn't it, being on a submarine? I mean, I've seen the numbers of the 52 subs lost during World War II, and that a greater percentage of the submarine force was lost than any other segment of the military in World War II. You say you never had a bad day, but this was a pretty dangerous job you had.
I think just too young or just accept the fact, hey, this is what I chose and this is it. Mm-hmm. Something's going to happen. It's up to the Lord, you know. Mm-hmm. If it's my time, it's my time. At least if it does happen, I won't be alone. It's just something that fear, it never entered my mind. I knew it was dangerous, but anything was dangerous. I mean, my God, my brother's on a battleship. He's in a forward gun turret and they get hit during the invasion of Normandy. He ends up in a hospital.
Yeah.
And he's on a battleship.
Right. And you've already lost two brothers before you ever got in. So I guess that hits home, that no matter where you were, it was going to be dangerous. So as an electrician's mate, though, on the Sennett, what kinds of things did you have to do? Was it all putting out fires, you know, electronic things that had to be fixed, or were there other things?
Well, anything that's, you know, the thing in electrical and in a ship, it's only two wires. A house, you got three wires. So you don't get involved in that. No, well, when you're operating off of batteries and you're switching from diesel engines to batteries and stuff, and you have the motor control room, you're operating all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Of course, if there's something electrical, even changing a light bulb, you got to call electricians, mate. But you keep busy.
What about when you're engaged with the enemy? Did you have a general quarter station, battle station?
Yeah, general quarter station. My general quarter station was by the main control panel.
So you're kind of just sitting there taking it all in?
Yeah, you're listening.
You're listening to the captain?
Well, yeah, you're listening. You got headsets on, you got headphones on, and so forth. And, you know, whether you're in the deck gang or whether you're in the engineering, you've got a job to do. And some guys, all they do is chip paint. Some guys are working on engines. Or some guys are working on a mast, fixing the radio antennas. You don't think about those things. I mean, it's hard for some people to understand that, but that's the way it is.
And it takes every one of those people. Yeah.
Yeah. You're submerged. Where are you going to go? You can't go no place. All you can do is pray and say, you know, if it's to be, it's to be, and accept it.
Do you have some examples of moments where that urge or necessity to pray crescendoed for you?
I always pray. I pray regardless.
Good habit to be in.
Yeah.
And as you say that, that doesn't sound like a superstition for you. You had a real belief that God is looking out for you.
That's right. Yeah. Of course, when I decided to further the education, which I really deprived myself, I mean, nobody pushed me into the service. It was my choice. I could have stayed in New Jersey. I just didn't want to have to go work in a foundry or something like that.
Right.
And I figured, you know, I want to do better. It's a shame because I'm sure there's a lot of young kids that are in high school. They should know what's out there for them, the opportunities that are there. If you're going to graduate high school and you're going to go to college, wonderful. But a lot of people don't have that opportunity. And you can get that opportunity. I have a granddaughter right now. She's going to Grand Canyon University. And her idea is when she graduates, she's already inquired with the Navy. They told her that when she graduates Grand Canyon University, she joins the Navy. I think she has to go for 6 years. They'll even pay for her to go to Baylor to get her master's. So how can you go wrong? And fortunately, my wife and I, together with her parents, are seeing that she gets her college degree. So that's what it's all about. But the opportunities are there. But when I came out, I wanted something more because at that time, after World War II, they had what they called a 5250 club. The government would pay you $50 for 52 weeks, then you're done. So I figured, well, I got to do something more now. I put a lot of years in engineering, which you're classified as electrician. So I went to San Francisco, and I applied for a merchant marine license. And the guy giving the exam happened to be an ex-Navy chief. And he said, how many years do you have in engineering? And I told him, between active and reserve, 12 years. He says, right now, he says, you can qualify for third assistant engineering officer. And he says, you got time, you want to take the test. Well, how long is it? Well, it's a 3-hour test. Okay, well, I finished it in less than an hour. Fortunately, I made a 97, so he goes, oh my God, why don't you take second engineering? And I figured, okay, now I'm getting cocky, you know. That's a 4-hour test. I took that test, and I made like a 92. He goes, holy smokes, he says, why don't you come back in the morning and take first assistant? Because after that, you're chief engineer, you're equivalent to the captain. Now I'm really feeling cocky, you know. I said, okay, fine. So I go back the next morning at 8 o'clock. He gives me this pamphlet. Of course, they didn't have computers in those days. I sat down. I'm looking. About 20 minutes, I go up to his desk, and he looks, and he says, you're not done. And I says, man, I couldn't answer the first 5 questions. It's all about propellers, the pitch and the size. Forget it. So anyhow, I did get a second assistant engineering officer, and he told me that before Atlantic bought Richfield, became ARCO, It was Atlantic Refining, and right. They had their base on the Delaware River in Philadelphia. He said, they're putting a crew together for an 18-month cruise in the Persian Gulf. They need a second assistant. Are you willing? I said, sign me up. And that's what I did. And I had enough money that I didn't have to worry about going for 4 years when I went to LaSalle. And that's all due to the military. That's the opportunity. The door is open.
Absolutely. But in order to walk through that open door, you had to survive the war.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned the Senate's war record. You mentioned praying a lot. I'm sure our listeners would be interested in what some of those close calls would be, or the exploits of your sub.
I don't know the actual count. I know that we sunk quite a few cargo ships. I believe there was a tanker, but there were quite a few cargo ships.
How does that unfold within the walls of that submarine when you're firing torpedoes and then you find out whether or not they actually struck their target?
Oh, you can hear it when it hits. And you can feel it because the shockwave goes through the water.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, seriously, I mean, don't misunderstand me. I mean, I was raised as a Catholic. I'm a fourth degree member of the Knights of Columbus. I believe in Jesus. But I don't walk around with the Bible and hit people in the head with it. But I'm a strong believer in religion. And I believe that we do have an afterlife. And I figured, well, when we're done here, we're going to see something else. And maybe I'll get to sit with all my brothers and sisters one day. But when you knew that you hit a ship, you knew there were men on it. And you knew that a lot of them were going to die. And I have to be honest, I used to really feel sorry and sad, knowing that these guys were just like I was. And it's over for them. A lot of guys would cheer and yell and clap. And I would just feel sorry, and I would more or less say a silent prayer, not knowing any of them. And very simple, you know, Lord, just take care of them. They're the enemy, but they're human beings. And I would console myself that way.
What about moments where you thought, as you just said, hey, that could easily be me. What about the moments where you thought maybe it was about to be you, where your number was about to be called?
Well, like I said before, you're pretty busy. There's a lot of activity going on. If it happens, you're not going to be like you were. These guys were on the old Squalus, if you remember that, when that sunk. You know, I think there was 28 guys that got into a compartment, they closed the hatch, and they survived.
Right.
But a lot of them lost their life.
Yeah.
And it was fast for them. I mean, you're not going to lay there and suffer. When it happens, it happens. It's done. The fear never entered my mind. I always figured someone's there watching for me.
Was there anything really unique about life on a submarine that you experienced then that maybe you haven't experienced since?
Well, one thing about it that I found out, that everybody's a buddy. You know, everybody's friendly. Most of the people on first name basis, you know, the captain, you call him captain. And I never experienced any hostilities between crew members. And it was a good thing, because you never know, because that's a guy who could probably save your life, you know. When I got out of the subs, and the reason I got out of the subs is because I saw another challenge, and that was they were advertising for deep sea salvage divers.
Right, which is another new thing.
Yeah,
that had never really been done before.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I enjoyed it. It was great. It was challenging. I've done a lot of salvage operations. But, you know, once I got out of it, there's a saying in the Navy, there's no duty like your last duty. And I really somewhat regretted leaving the subs. Mm. The boats were great. Although I would say that Navy salvage ship, they also have a small crew, smaller crew, anywhere from 85 to 110 officers and men. But once again, everybody's close. And it's exciting, and that's dangerous.
When did you get on the Senate?
Latter part of 44, because I was just temporarily on the Sea Robin. And the reason I was on there, they needed a second-class electrician. They borrowed me.
Well, the only reason I ask those details is I'm just looking at some of the official history of the Senate. And, you know, the very first couple patrols here, you know, here's an instance where your sub is attacking a Japanese mine layer. Mm-hmm. And according to this account, two torpedoes were heard to explode, but while going deep, the Senate was rocked hard by two aircraft bombs, which exploded beneath her. The sub surfaced an hour later and saw the oil slick and the Japanese who had been on the ship that you guys sunk. But I'm thinking about those aircraft bombs exploding beneath your sub.
Mm-hmm.
And something like that get your attention a little bit?
Oh, get your attention, yeah. You know, you rock and you pitch and so forth, you know, and you hold on.
But no big deal, you're saying, for you.
I mean, not to a point where you panic.
Just another thing I stumbled across here not long after that. Well, I guess in April, there was a situation where you guys tried to save a P-51 pilot who had bailed out.
Yeah.
But were unable to find him.
Right.
Did you guys get called in on rescue opportunities like that a lot?
Yeah, we did. Most of the time, he couldn't find the guys.
That must have been tough.
Yeah, it is tough. I'd hate to see anybody lose their life, enemy or otherwise. That's just a feeling I have.
So you said most of the time, which does not mean the same as all the time. There were instances where you guys were able to pull out downed airmen.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what happened to President Bush. He
right?
got shot down.
Exactly.
And thank God they were coming out to get him.
Yeah, that wasn't your sub, just
no,
so
no.
People aren't confused. But
yeah.
I guess what I'm interested in is what that's like on a sub. When you guys are looking, and you know what it feels like to look for somebody and not find them, but then you actually do find the guy and you save his life.
Well, there's two things you got to look at. Number one, you're surfaced, you're looking for him.
Yeah.
But you're also looking for an enemy, too.
Uh-huh.
And you got to remember, we did not have the sophisticated electronics that they have today.
Right.
So, you know, you might be up on the surface and, you know, there's another guy that's underwater and he's got you in his sights, and that could be it. Or aircraft, you don't know, but you try your best to try and find him. And after so long, if he's not around, you have to assume the fact that he's gone, and you feel bad about that, but you feel good about it when you do pick somebody up.
And I bet the guys you picked up felt really good. I bet you had some happy airmen coming aboard your sub.
Yeah, the pharmacist, well, of course, we called them pharmacist mate in those days. Today they're called medics.
Yeah,
you know, they'd get him right into the sick bay and take care of him. I know we took out a tanker, and I know there was two cargo ships.
Just in about the last month of the war in the Sea of Japan, mm-hmm. You're talking about?
Yeah.
That was your sub's most, I guess, prolific patrol.
Yeah, and it was shortly after that was when I went to salvage school. I thought I was going to go to Bayonne, New Jersey. That's where the dive school was, because I hadn't seen my grandparents in probably 10 years or better. And I figured, boy, I'm going to be in New Jersey. Bayonne's not too far from Burlington, where I was born, you know?
Yeah.
New Jersey's not that big of a state to begin with. And when I opened up my orders, they said, okay, you got your wish. And I said, what's going on? They said, well, you put in for dive school. I said, okay. Well, back then, they didn't seal your orders. You can open up and look at it. And of all things, it was U.S. Navy dive school, Gatun Lake, Panama Canal Zone. Of course, that's civilians own it now, but that's where I went. And then I was assigned to the ship that was just about finished, which was the USS Recovery, ARS 43, Auxiliary Repair Salvage, built in Napa. And the crew, we were all living on the barracks because they were finishing it up. Ended up, I had appendicitis, and I'm in a hospital. In fact, they had left once they did their shakedown cruise. They take it out, and they put it through all kind of tests and everything. And I think they towed a barge down to San Diego. And from San Diego, they went down to 15th Naval District, which was Panama. Well, I was still in the hospital. And then 2 months later, I got transportation, and I joined them in Panama. And we were actually at the sub base, which was called Balboa, right across the channel from Panama City on mm-hmm. the Pacific side.
How many times have you been through the Panama Canal?
73. The last time was a civilian. I took my wife and friends of mine from Fresno just before they took over the canal.
Uh-huh. Well, and just the decision to volunteer for dive school. Maybe people now say, oh, yeah, that's a neat adventure. But at the time, this is a pretty dangerous idea. And the technology was nothing like what we have now. Can you explain to us what you guys had to do to make one of these dives and what some of the risks and hazards were?
You know, first of all, there was no such thing in the Navy as scuba. They had shallow water masks, which was nothing more than a triangular mass. And for instance, if you're going to go below and clean the strainers off the bottom of the hull of a sub or something, and then they just hook it up to an air compressor. But your actual dive suit, it was a heavy rubberized, vulcanized dive suit. Your helmet was really heavy. It was spun copper.
Yeah.
And then you had your belt, you had your shoes and so forth. A lot of guys used to say, what are you going to do if you see a shark? Well, what can you do, you know?
And maybe if folks have seen the movie that Cuba Gooding Jr. made about Carl Brashear.
Yes.
Men of Honor?
Yes.
Is that what it was?
Yes.
That's the kind of equipment we're talking about, that you are at the same time training with this.
Yeah. Not the equipment when he was doing the test after he had his leg amputated. That was an upgraded equipment.
All right.
That may have been Hollywood. I've never seen that equipment. But the old hard hat was spun copper. I think once you were all decked out with the weights and everything, you were over 200 pounds, just in the probably about 260 pounds or so, depending on how much you put on.
Right. Really, really primitive.
Yeah. The dangers are not sharks or barracudas, unless you're bleeding. The dangers are when you're working below and you're working on a wreck or you're trying to bring something to the surface, is you got to be careful, because as you've seen in that movie, when he was going through dive school and they were on that old freighter and it started to slip off and the guy got pinned underneath. You know, there's a lot of danger when you're down there. Another danger is what happens? You step onto what they call a descending stage, and they put you over the side. They bring you down to the depth of your helmet, and you check everything out like a pilot does before he takes off. And then you're talking on a phone. The phone is speakers up in your helmet, and there's a lot of air coming in, so it's hard to understand. And you tell them you're ready to descend, and you step off the stage. And then you got handlers that handle the line. The cable, the telephone cable, that's also a lifeline cable. You got your air cables, and you're going down. Going down is not a problem. Then when you're on the bottom, you report you're on the bottom, and you do what you have to do. When you're coming up, depending on how deep you are, then you had to decompress, meaning you can only come up so far, and you have to stop. Because if you don't, you get the air bubbles, the nitrogen builds up in your blood vessels, and you end up what they call a bends, which could be fatal. That's why they have decompression chambers on these salvage ships. If you had the bends, they get you in there with a pharmacist mate, they seal it up, they close the hatch, and they actually turn on air pressure that brings you down to the pressure at the level you were below the water. And then they bring you up slowly. And then when you're watching your watch and you're talking topside, then you come up again, depending how deep you are. Now, that's all controlled by your air valve. I mean, these guys are not pulling you up. You're doing it.
Right.
They're just taking up the slack. You open it up too much, you get what's called spread eagle. That suit would spread out and your arms would go out. There is no way you're going to get your arms back down, and you'll find your body is packed in the helmet like a sardine. That is a danger. Other than that, it's just dangers when you're working on whatever you're working on, you know, whether it's a sunken ship or whether you're going down after a torpedo or a bomb that didn't go off. So it is dangerous, but, you know.
Yeah, we're starting to get the idea that Mike is pretty modest about what he's done. It's break time again, but we'll hear more about his time as a salvage diver, including a remarkable small world connection. And we'll also hear why he's still working hard as an advocate for insurance policyholders at age 88. Check out how youthfully he wears those years in the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Mike DeCesar of Madera, California, originally from New Jersey. And in 1946, after his time on submarines in World War II, a salvage diver aboard the USS Recovery. He was a plank owner, part of that ship's original crew. And he ended up being a guest of honor at her decommissioning nearly a half century later. But when we left off, he was explaining some of the dangers he and other divers encountered.
And when you describe those, you describe, you know, getting the bends or having the spread eagle. Those are not things that were theoretical or hypothetical or make sure this never happens. You guys knew that because you saw it happen to other people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nobody there to help you. If you just happen to crack that valve and you just let too much air come in, because that compressor is pumping air. It's up to you,
right,
how you want to control it. If you get too much air in, that suit will blow up because that, not blow up, explode. The suit itself will just inflate to a point where it would be physically impossible for you to bring your arms down to grab that valve, and
right,
it's over.
Yeah.
You know, what you'll do, you'll float to the surface. When you come to the surface, it'll pop, and like they say, you'll be in the helmet. Well, I'd never seen that, but that's what they told you.
Oof. No, thank you. And you mentioned some of the things that you would go diving after, and it just strikes me, given what you shared about your duty on subs at the end of World War II, where your whole purpose, you know, you had the occasional rescue missions, but most of the time you guys are trying to fire your torpedoes at enemy ships. Whether you're sinking cargo, you know that lives are at stake. Now, after the war, you're a diver on a salvage ship, the Recovery, which is hard to miss if you visit your office that you served on the Recovery. And that name is fitting because that's what you're doing. You're recovering, you're saving. Completely different purpose from destroying to saving.
Right.
And I get the sense that that mattered to you, that that made a difference or made it somehow more satisfying or more fulfilling for you.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I think I showed you a couple pictures. We had a Marine helicopter went down. Unfortunately, the pilot and his co-pilot didn't get out, but that was off the coast of Costa Rica. And we got the call on that. The waters, you know, down there, they're just so clear that it looked like they're 10 feet deep and it could be 200 feet. But, you know, you go down and you're not trying to look inside, see the bodies. What you're doing, you're down there and you've got what they call cable straps, and you cable it where you think that it's going to hold so they can bring it back up. And, of course, once they bring it up, they put it on the fantail or the stern of the ship and they cover it. You don't touch the bodies. You don't have anything to do with that. You know, on another occasion, there was a C-45, which is a twin engine, twin tail. That crashed. That was Air Force. And that was off of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and you've got a picture of you guys pulling that thing up.
Yeah, I think the one that I really stands out the most was the salvaging of a T-2 tanker, the Royal Oak, which ran aground off of Ecuador and was sinking.
This is a really neat story. So this tanker runs aground, it's sinking, and you guys get the word to come to the rescue, but you've got a long way to go, right? You had to go through the canal to get there?
Yep. We were just coming in from Guantanamo Bay, and we're waiting in line to get into the first lock on the Atlantic side of the Panama Canal. And, of course, so-called station, or our shop, was right next to the yeoman. And the yeoman is like the ship's secretary. So first thing he does, I was just in the shop working on something. I don't know what it was. We had our table and our tools in there. And he runs in, he calls me, he says, "Hey, DeCesar," he said, "we got a great assignment." I said, "What are we doing?" He says, "Man, we're heading to Ecuador. I just heard from the radio shack." And off he goes. So we had priority to get through the canal. I think we got through. It normally takes about 7.5 hours. But we got through, and I think it was about 5 hours and 20 minutes, tied up to the docks at Balboa Sub Base, single up lines, just one line on the bow, one line on the stern, took on water, took on fuel, took on food, and we're gone at flank speed. And, of course, we have a general idea where this ship is at. But once again, we didn't have the sophisticated equipment. And our captain, who's an ex-Merchant Marine captain, he was a lieutenant commander. His name was Jack Moritz, M-O-R-I-T-Z. Great guy. He was not an academy guy, so he didn't believe in the book. He made an announcement. Whoever spots that tanker first gets a three-day pass. Well, we had a young kid from L.A. He spotted it, and I climbed up the foremast with my camera. I took a picture of it, and it was on a 32-degree list.
That is severe.
That's very severe.
And you have that picture that you took
on your wall
in your office. I'll put it up at hometownheroesradio.com. But I just wanted to mention that that's severe, because some people who don't know what a 32-degree list is, I mean, it's getting pretty close to capsizing.
Well, if it didn't have fuel in the tanks, it would have capsized.
Yeah.
So it ripped open two tanks is what it did, and it was gasoline. It was chartered by the government. It was owned by City Service Oil Company, and I believe they were taking fuel either to Peru or Chile, to the Air Force or whatever. But anyhow, when we spotted it, the crew was all in lifeboats, but they left one man on board. And the reason for that, there was a Grace Lines cargo ship that wanted to claim salvage rights. But as long as you have one live body on board, they can't do that.
Uh-huh.
And I think he was the engineering officer. So they got all the crew on board the recovery, and then our salvage officer, I think he was on vacation, so they wanted an assessment what we thought if we could save it. So we went over with the chief boatswain mate, machinist mate, ship fitter, myself, one other diver. You can imagine climbing on that ship that's at a 32-degree list. I mean, you're pulling yourself up is what you're doing.
Yeah.
So we thought that if we could get a compressor, we can cut some panels and weld them over where the hull was ripped, we'd be able to pump it out. Of course, the recovery, like the rest of the ARSs, that's all power. They have huge stripper pumps on them to pump water out. So they pumped the water out, and we got it up from a 32-degree list to a 2-degree list, and we towed it back to Panama to the Panama Shipbuilding Company. To me, that was one of the most memorable salvage operations that I was on.
What all did you have to do to get it back into that situation, you personally?
Well, there was two divers and there was three apprentice divers. They were cutting sheet metal panels that are between compartments. Mm-hmm. And they would cut them, and then you're very buoyant under the water. And then we'd get it over top of where the hull was ripped, and then we would weld it.
That's what I wanted to establish. You had to dive under the surface, go down to these damaged portions of the ship, and repair them under the water?
Yeah, the tanks are 40 feet deep.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, you're underwater. Then once you do that, they put their stripper pumps on and they pump it out. That damn stripper pumps, they're like, I think, 18-inch diameter. They shoot water out 100 feet, and you can just see it coming up.
Was there some anticipation for that moment, thinking, is this going to hold? Is this going to work right? Or did we miss something under there?
No, the only anticipation was don't start sliding again because it was on a shelf.
Uh-huh. It had hit something under the surface that they couldn't see.
And it was right there in an area called Punta Galera, right off of the northwestern section of Ecuador.
And that was 1946.
1946.
But the memory of that ship came around many years later in your work life.
Yeah, well, I'll step back. During my research, because I started to write a book on it, during my research, I found out in the Ecuadorian newspaper, they had a write-up on it. You look at it today, it cost $75,000 to repair that ship.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that today it probably cost you $1 million.
Oh, at least.
Yeah. Years later, I was with working for National Flood Insurance, and I had this claim with a captain in the sheriff's office. His house suffered about 6 or 7 feet of flood water. When it receded, I was handling that case for him, and I went in, and I happened to notice on a wall, I says, oh, that's a T2 tanker. And he goes, oh, you know about those? And I said, yeah, I was a salvage diver. In fact, I helped rescue one of those. And he goes, where was it? And I said, it was off the coast of Ecuador. And he said, was it called the Royal Oak? And I was shocked. And I said, yeah, how do you know? He said, my grandfather was the captain. That was his last trip. He left, he came back, and he gave me a cardboard box, and it had everything in it, the ship's log and everything else, which I have. What a small world. And this is what? Back in around 1994, I think, when they had the 500-year flood.
So almost 50 95. Years later.
Yeah, almost 50 years later. And if I didn't see that picture, I'd have never known it.
Right, but he got to meet one of the guys who saved his grandfather's ship.
Yeah, and saved his grandfather, because the crew, believe it or not, we had his grandfather under guard in the recovery's dispensary because they threatened to kill him.
For running aground.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if anyone's listening that was on that ship, the guys, they were something else. They were the dirtiest bunch of guys you ever seen. The guys chewing tobacco, spitting on the deck on the inside of the compartments. The boatswain mate would just run them out. But it was okay. It saved them all.
Yeah, no big deal. We keep hearing that humility shine through. And I have a feeling there are some things you're not telling us that we'd be amazed by. I do know one thing you're proud of, and I have a link to some of the news coverage of this in our story at hometownheroesradio.com. You helped secure a Purple Heart for one of your fellow World War II vets who had clearly deserved it, but after nearly 70 years had given up hope that it was ever going to happen.
This fellow was shot severely, continued to climb the hill, hand-grenaded the German machine gun nest, killed all the Germans, and saved 283 American soldiers.
This is Martin Medellin.
Martin Medellin.
Of Madera, California.
Madera, California.
And he had the Silver Star, but you just described his injuries, and he'd never been given the Purple Heart. Almost 70 years after the war, he didn't have the Purple Heart.
Yeah.
And you did something about that.
Yeah.
Because you were the adjutant of the VFW post that he's a member of.
And I did it as a friend and a fellow veteran, because Martin said, I'm not looking for notoriety. I'd like to have this for my family. And I says, I will try everything I can to get this for you. I tracked it down because his sergeant was a Sergeant Peterson, who on a different assignment a week later lost his life, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor. I tracked him down, where he came from there, where he's buried at the American Military Cemetery in Holland. We get the medal, but we want to do it as a surprise. So we have it on a night that our post is open to the public for dinner. The place is jam-packed. I mean, people are against the walls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm up there with a sling. Now, remember, I get out of the hospital 11 o'clock that morning. And this is the first thing that I read.
All right.
A friend. The definition of a friend is described as a patron, a supporter, a comrade, and a person who gives assistance. 29 years ago, I met such a person, and he became my friend, a former Air Force colonel in one of the Central American countries that was involved in the Civil War. With the help of the United States, he and his family escaped to the United States, and he later became a high-level member in our country's intelligence organization. We have since stayed in constant contact, as friends should. Over the past 6 months or so, I set out on a mission, a promise to help a local World War II veteran and a friend. I sent 19 letters to the U.S. representatives, senators, and other politicians in Washington, D.C. Not one ever answered. Obviously, they had no time to help a wounded World War II hero. So I turned to my friend in Arlington, Virginia. My friend stepped in to help my friend in Madera, who is here tonight and help me complete my promise. Would all of you please stand to honor our hero and to share these next few moments? This is his citation. Martin Medellin, Private First Class U.S. Army, Company K, 18th Infantry Regiment, 1st Infantry Division. On 1 January 1945 in Philippsburg, France, 283 United States soldiers were trapped by German machine guns. Private Medellin and his sergeant, George Peterson, were ordered to climb a hill and destroy the machine gun nest and the enemy. In climbing the hill, Private Medellin was shot by a German sniper in the left shoulder. The bullet passed through the shoulder and through the front of his throat. He continued his mission, disregarding his wounds. Both he and his sergeant launched hand grenades into the German machine gun nest, destroying the machine gun nest and killing the German soldiers, saving all 283 trapped American soldiers. Private Medellin was treated by a field medic. He deserved the Purple Heart Medal for his injuries. He was awarded the Silver Star, the third highest medal awarded for gallantry against the enemy, the Bronze Star, and a number of additional medals. He was later promoted to sergeant, although all members of this post call him the general. Finally, after 69 years, 2 months, and 6 days, Martin Medellin, I am proud to present you your Purple Heart and Medal, and I will ask our post commander, Henry Arredondo, the honor to pin this medal upon you. And the back of the medal has his serial number. So, how do I feel about that?
How do you feel about that?
I feel great that I helped this guy. This is something he wanted to do for his family. I spent many, many hours, and you can see the size of this file. An investigation carried me to the state of New Jersey, to Washington, to Arlington, and to the U.S. military cemetery in Holland. I finally accomplished that mission. I would not and could not reveal who this colonel was or what country he came from, but it was a country I believe that during President Reagan's presidency that we assisted that country, and the Marine colonel that helped get him here and snuck him out with his family. So I promised those names I would never, ever reveal.
Right. But they were able to make the connection to get the Purple Heart authorized.
In less than 3 weeks after that call to my friend, FedEx delivered a box. And in the box, beautiful box with a blue velvet lining, was the Purple Heart and a lapel pin. He is very grateful. His family is very grateful. And I felt very honored to be able to help him out and give him peace of mind that when he leaves this earth to go to someplace better, at least his family will have what he always was not able to get.
Amen.
And that's payment to me in full.
Well, and I got that sense. I didn't want to exaggerate or go too far, but it almost seems that that opportunity to seek and deliver that Purple Heart for your friend is something that you're as proud of as your own years in the Navy.
Absolutely.
And with regard to your time in the Navy, with everything you experienced during World War II and after, some real trailblazing work with the divers, is there something that you'd say that you're most proud of?
Well, I'm thankful for the opportunity of what the military did for me, education-wise. Looking back, I thank the folks that took me out here, although at the time I didn't appreciate it because I was nothing but a mule. But years later, you realize that they helped me to get where I am today. And I think, as I mentioned to you, the greatest thing that sticks out in my mind was the salvaging of that T-2 tanker, which incidentally, as you note, there's a instrument on this table.
Mm-hmm.
That belonged to the guy's great-grandfather.
This is for Celestial Navigation?
Yes, and he thought I should have it. So, you know, there's always ways of payment other than actual dollars and cents.
Yeah.
I don't do it for dollars and cents. When I do something to help somebody, such as a veteran or how this came about, it's because I believe in what goes around comes around. And I've been blessed.
You have. And I'm just kind of looking back over everything we've talked about. And I'm sure we could stay here for hours and hours listening to some of your stories. But for a kid who never knows his mother, never has the opportunity really to get to know his siblings, goes cross country on a train at age 9 to live with people that you didn't know, to have experienced all these things since then. I mean, what are the odds that a story that starts out like that takes all the twists and turns and arrives at where we are today? How do you explain all that?
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people in this country and in this world that have probably followed the same road that I have. It's what you want out of life, what you want to do. If you want to just flip hamburgers and you're happy with that, so be it. I was happy working on the farm, even though it was hard, but I wanted something better. I knew nothing about United States Armed Forces Institute to get a high school diploma. I didn't know anything about the GI Bill, but when I found out about it, I said, I want it, and I worked for it. Nobody handed it to me, and I look at today, a lot of people say, your age, why are you working? Number one, I like to help people. That's why I'm an advocate for policyholders, to see that they get what they really have coming to them. It's just a feeling and the satisfaction you get helping people.
So how long are you going to keep working?
That's another part of a story. I recently testified in a case in Modesto, and the attorney for the insurance company inquiring my age, he asked a question that you should never ask, using the word why. Why are you working at your age? Frankly, I don't have to. I have Social Security. I got VA disability benefit. I've worked all these years. I own this place free and clear. I don't owe anybody anything. And I'll tell you exactly what I did. And it's a matter of court record. And I looked at him and I said, Your Honor, this is somewhat of a sensitive subject. Do I have to answer it? And he looked at me and he said, well, go ahead. And if it gets to a point, I'll stop you. But we had retired military on the jury. Of course, I'm wearing my hat because at the time, the high intensity lights, my right eye only had 20% vision until I had surgery.
And your hat is a hat that says World War II veteran.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they're connecting with me.
Yep.
And I asked the judge, is it at all possible, could I wear my hat because of this condition? And what would happen? I said, 1946, I fell off a ship's mast and broke my neck, and the calcium is pressing against the optical nerve, and I'm supposed to have surgery in 2 weeks. He said, I got something better. He tells the deputy, turn the bank of lights off. This is in a new building, high-intensity lights, and I wouldn't. 20 minutes, I wouldn't be able to read a document. I would get a kaleidoscope. So to answer the attorney, and after the judge says, well, go ahead, I looked at the jury, and this is exactly what I said. My oldest son did 8 years in the United States Navy nuclear submarines. When he was discharged, he moved back east, he married a woman, he had children. He joined the police department. 14 years later, he lost his life while he was on duty. I made a promise that I would see that his children went to college. They are going to college, and I pay for their entire college. They have 2 years to go. When they graduate, I will then retire. So that's why I'm working at my age. I am told that there were two female jurors that were crying. That jury came back with a combined general and punitive damage on a claim that was $877,000. $10.5 million.
I guess they shouldn't ask you why you're still working, huh?
Should never ask that question, why, unless you know the answer.
But you know, by telling me that story, you opened up one more question I have to ask you.
Sure.
We didn't talk about you falling from a mast. That could have killed you.
Well, what had happened, we were at sea. It wasn't rough, but we were doing maybe 10 degree rolls side to side, and I was down the motor control room on watch. It was nighttime, and of course at that time ships would talk to each other with the lights off the yard arms, which is the crossbow on the main mast. The phone rang. I answered it, and they said, some of the lights are out on the forward mast. We have what we call an apprentice in the Navy. We call him a striker electrician. He's an apprentice. Mm-hmm. I said, go up to the fore mast and change them bulbs up there. It's probably a couple of bulbs. So about 20 minutes later, the bridge calls back down again. We were on our way back to Panama. They said, what seems to be the holdup? I said, I don't know, but I'll find out. I went up, and the young fellow was sitting on the anchor windlass machine, which is a huge machine that pulls the anchor up. I says, what are you doing? He said, I can't climb the mast. I said, why can't you climb it? I'm scared. I said, there's nothing to be scared about. He said, but I can't go. I can't go. I said, give me your belt. So I went up, climbed it, shimmied out, which I've done before. And when I'm coming back, I'm on the third rung. These are like big U-bolts, but they're heavy iron or steel. Welded to the mast. A weld broke. Snagged my jacket, and I'm swinging back and forth. They're coming up to get me, but the jacket tears. I fell 42 feet. I broke my neck, my wrist, my left hip.
And you didn't think this was worth mentioning before?
Not really. You asked me the question, I promise I'd answer you. So after all these years, I started to have this problem. But I'm fine now.
42 feet?
42 feet.
How are you alive?
Split my head wide open. How am I alive? Once again, faith. He was with me.
Must have been.
I was unconscious for 11 days.
Holy smokes. And that was 1946.
1946.
And was the situation with your eyesight something that got worse over time?
Yeah, or? Because the calcium started pressing against the optical nerve.
Uh-huh.
In fact, that happened to be December the 10th, I believe, 1946, just before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. So that's 70 years ago. It's a long time to be living on borrowed time.
Yeah.
So. You were 18 years old.
Yep.
You should have died at 18. Really?
Yeah.
That's who survives a 42-foot fall landing on their head?
Actually, I think I hit with my right shoulder and my hip, and then the rest of my body, like my head that was split across the front and my neck that broke. That was the second when my body went down and hit another part of the machinery.
Uh-huh. Unconscious for 11 days.
Yep.
So when you come to, what are those moments like? When you start to understand what happened and what kind of shape you're in?
Well, when I come to, I'm not moving very much. I got a thing around my neck. I got a cast on my arm. I've got a sling around my shoulder. Cast that goes almost halfway up and above my hip.
So most people would be thinking, boy, this is going to be rough.
I did, but once again, you know, I just asked for prayer. They said, you will probably be in the hospital for a good year and a half. Well, 5.5 months later, I was back on the ship with light duty.
Wow. Any other secrets I didn't ask you about you want to share, Mike?
No. We could sit here a long time. Once again, I'm going to reach out to young fellas and young girls. You know, we live in the valley here. There's a lot of people live in poverty. There's a lot of families that are struggling, that they want to do the best they could for their kids. But unfortunately, they did not have the opportunity that they could afford to do this. So some kids that might start high school, they may never finish. They've got to go out. They've got to work to help their family survive. Those that do finish high school, unless they get grants, will never see the doors open going to college. If young people are listening to this and you feel that there's nothing for you, that you have to resort to crime to make money and whatever else, or you have to spend the rest of your life, once again, there's no disgrace in flipping hamburgers, but there's a lot more out there for you. That could be a stepping stone. Think about the service. Think about the benefits. If you don't want to go to college, you can learn almost anything in the military. Do that 20 years, you got lifetime retirement, got education waiting for you. You got a trade that can carry you through, and you got free medical for the rest of your life. That's something that I experienced, and I would encourage young folks, and I do.
Well said. Well, there's something I don't want to forget to say, and that is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, for sharing some of your remarkable story with us. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
I think that's about it. I thank you, and I will say one thing. The service to me, the Navy, was one of the greatest parts of my life. I've had a lot of great parts, but that was one of the greatest. And I was very honored to do what little that I did, together with millions of other young men and women who are doing what they're doing today to hopefully keep this country free. And we all have to be with them. We have to have them in our prayers. I pray for them every night. And for those that lose their life, I pray that those gates will be left open so they'll have no delay going into that heavenly paradise.
Well, I trust that was the case for those two brothers of yours killed on December 7th, 1941. And I'm sure Victor and Vito would be very proud of their baby brother. What a story. Mike DeCesar, 88 years young. And if you enjoyed hearing from Mike and you'd like to hear a little bit more, the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com features another 20 minutes or so with this spirited storyteller. You'll find photos and videos of Mike on the website too, as well as on Facebook if you just punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. Thanks for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.